Hey, thanks for downloading the podcast. And remember, if you want to listen live, download the iHeartRadio app, download the TuneIn app, and just search for Fantasy Sports Radio Network, and you can listen to this program live. Also, if you want to watch the video of this podcast, check us out on YouTube, on Twitch, or on Periscope, and type in, you guessed it, Fantasy Sports Network. You'll find us there. Enjoy the show, and thanks for listening.
This is In This League Overtime. Some of the best from Chris Welsh and Scott Bogman on the In This League Podcast Network and FNTSY. Now, it's time for OT.
So, Bogman, why don't you kick us off here? Because we were talking about exit velocity earlier, and you kind of posed this question. But we're also going to, obviously, we're going to kind of review some of the book debates that Rob took part in. We got some Blue Jays stuff, of course, but Bogman, why don't you kick it off?
So we talked about some guys that have improved their average exit velocity early in the season. Do you think that it's too early to use this advanced type of stat to see who is actually improving this season, or should we be impressed by these numbers? A couple guys we talked about were Moustakas has really raised his, DJ LeMahieu, Mitch Haniger, Hanley, and Chris Iannetta were the guys that we pointed out. They've had heavy increases in their average exit velocity.
So if the question was on the pitching side, I think on the pitching side, especially guys who have big drops in velocity, I think that's actionable. On the exit velocity for the hitting side, I know people say, smart people say, these numbers stabilize very quickly. I don't think we know yet how useful it is on a going forward basis, not just like two, three weeks into the season. I don't think we know at what point, if ever, exit velocity and launch angle supersede rest of season projections. Now, that's a big statement. Let me unpack that briefly. Guy named Michael Leichman, I think I'm pronouncing it right, MGL, who's blocked basically everybody on Twitter, but he's one of the leading sabermetrics guys ever. He wrote the book with Tom Tango. He was one of the three co-authors. And he's by all accounts, a giant. Because he blocked me. He blocked everybody.
I like the idea, by the way, of someone that is like that, like big in kind of the world of creation, goes on a social media platform and then makes himself unavailable to everybody. There's something special about that.
I don't even remember what I said to get blocked. It had nothing to do with baseball, but it also wasn't
probably just high.
Yeah, like it was just anyways. He did a study before he blocked me, so I actually saw it. He did a study that I think is the most, arguably the most important sabermetrics study for fantasy baseball that nobody seems to have read. And what he did was a study on when a player's season-to-date numbers can tell us what he's like more likely to do than his rest-of-season projections from a projection model. And it was a two-part study. He did it both for hitters and for pitchers. And his basic finding was, the answer is never, that the rest of season projection is always going to give you a better forward-looking view on a player than the season-to-date projections. Now, obviously, by definition, that's not true on all hitters because they're human beings doing something. We don't know exactly what every single one of them is going to do. But certainly, collectively, rest of season numbers and this was before StatCast, obviously. This was 2014. Was always going to be a more accurate projection. I'd be curious, and boy, if I could tweet him, maybe I'd tweet him this, to what extent launch angle and exit velocity changes that, if at all. My gut, though, is as a class of players, you are still much better looking at rest of season projections than trying to pick out who the outliers are with exit velocity and launch angle. But I could be wrong. That may not be true. I'd be curious to see somebody smart actually study it. I might have to ask Jeff Zimmerman to do that.
Hey, there you go. Well, see, you know what we just said before? When we mentioned the whole thing being a universal listen here and then listen, is we maybe we just sparked your guys' next episode.
My guess is because we've only got three seasons of StatCast that we don't know the answer to that yet. And, you know, the streamers of the world are obviously starting to incorporate StatCast data in it. But my gut is, as a class, you're better off. Look, as I said, I know I'm repeating myself seven times here, which if you're looking, listen to it really quickly, you just think that there's a jump in the podcast or something at this point. But that's not really your question. Your question is the outlier. Is Hanley Ramirez healthy now? And therefore, can we assume this Hanley Ramirez is far more similar to 3 years ago, 4 years ago Hanley Ramirez? And his projections don't reflect that because his projections are full of injured seasons. That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. But those are the kinds of guys where I think that you need to go beyond the projections. Hanley Ramirez, because you know there's reason to think that he is capable of a better season than his projection would say. Why? Because we've seen it from him in the past. So it's not that you're just hoping that something amazing's happened. You're hoping that he's healthy, and there's lots of reasons to think that.
When you, I think it's interesting what we're talking about here too, because we're in this is April is a season of baseball, and what I mean by that is it's overreaction season in April. Mm-hmm. It's small sample size time. It's overreaction. It's reactions to everything we see. And it's got layers. You know, you've got the stat layer, which is just for everybody. In every league that they play, people look at the stats and like, well, oh my God, Jed Lowry's the best player in baseball. I should trade him for Jose Ramirez. You've got, you know, the stat readers. You've got digging under a bit, people looking at BAPIP, XFIP. And then obviously you've got the big trend now where it's we're going to take everything. We're going to take barrel rate. We're going to take launch angle. We're going to take swinging strike percentage. And all of those things, like when is, I guess what I'm asking, and I'm kind of formulating it all together to say, when is the level where you start to believe any of this stuff, where you can really take a look at these? Because the question before was, is it too early? But when is the time where you really, where the sample size has grown big enough to make calculated decisions on players? Because I do think we're in a place where it's been really difficult, where people have put their foot down and been like, oh my God, we got to worry about Jose Ramirez, you know, or oh my God, we got to worry about this guy or that guy, or Patrick Corbin is a Cy Young contender. I feel like it's been too early at that, and a lot of people have used these analytics to tell their story early on. But when for you are you comfortable making these type of decisions, whether it's normal stats or advanced?
Next November. I'm pretty good at this.
Okay, so when the season's done. All right, perfect.
No, more seriously, it depends on the player. So on a Jose Ramirez, like months and months and months, because what am I going to do about it? Yeah. Like if let's say he were still struggling, and after this weekend, I think he's probably now a top 20 player on the season. That's the other thing. It can change really quickly, right? Mookie Betts becomes a top five player on the season in two games, basically. It's pretty easy to do still at this season. The top guys that you drafted at the top, unless there's an injury, so unless there is reason to think that they're pitching hurt, that they're playing hurt, their role has changed, so they're playing only 3 days a week instead of 7 days a week, and that may never change back again. So Ian Happ, for example, it's not so much that I think Ian Happ is junk. It's if I drafted Ian Happ in a premium position, I'm not sure that I'm getting more than 350, 400 plate appearances unless he starts playing better again. That changes his projection. That changes his contribution to my team. That changes what I can count on getting him from. So it's not that I think he's way worse than I did before. It's the context has changed.
Makes sense. I kind of look at it, to be super dumb about it and just linear, like I see it and I'm just like, well, I feel like I can start making like positive or negative decisions on players once I've got like 6 weeks, like mid-May. It's almost like it doesn't actually make sense, but I feel like, you know, around May 15th, I can really start to like have a grasp on, you know, the trends being real, which might be beyond being able to make a decision negatively or positively, like in your favor. You know, being able to trade a guy by May if they've been struggling the whole time, it doesn't really do anything because they've been struggling that long and people have escaped.
So that's the guys you drafted at the top of your roster. At the bottom of your roster, you need to be real quick, especially in mixed leagues. You know, if you're in an AL or only NL only league, cutting, saying you should cut this guy, it's cut him for who, right? You know, maybe maybe in your AL only league today, Gurriel is on the waiver wire, so you're going to bid 25, 30, 40% of your fab budget to pick up Gurriel or something. But most weeks, you're dealing with a guy who got five at-bats last week, is the best hitter available in your AL only league. But in mixed leagues, you should be churning the bottom of your roster constantly. Like, you should have, in a 15-team mixed league, every single week, a hitter and a pitcher who you're saying bye-bye to. If you're not, either you're killing it on fab and have gotten lucky, or you're valuing guys who you drafted too high. So an example, this week, Kansas City has eight games. If they have a doubleheader next Sunday, the White Sox are the Royals who have eight games this week. One of those teams has eight games this week. You should, in a 12 or 15 team mixed league, have somebody who you can cut for somebody who's not awesome on one of those, whichever team it is. This is really helpful advice. Whichever team it is, does eight games. Because for this 1 week, a mediocre hitter on that team, if you forecast them to play, let's say, seven out of eight games, is more valuable than the bottom guy on your roster, at least should be. And that's a 1 week pickup.
All right. So kind of like in what we're talking about here, maybe we could even pinpoint a little bit, even though this is vague in nature. Do you have any guys positively or negatively that you believe this season's kind of long trend that people need to be aware of? Like, you're buying into this struggle, you're buying into this positive. It almost kind of becomes like these are some guys, you know, probably more pick-upable. But if there are some, you know, big named players that maybe you felt negatively about, you can do that. But who are some positive or negative trends that you've really bought into that maybe are beating projections?
Well, Jed Lowry is obviously going to be the AL MVP. So do whatever you need to do to get Jed Lowry. The counter, you're not picking him up on fab, but the counter argument to my Ian Happ comment is Javi Baez. Mm. Because the reason why Javi Baez was not somebody I was chasing going into the season was a playing time concern. There were just too many bodies there. He's just too good right now. And what Joe Maddon has shown is he'll play Rizzo and Bryant every single day as he's doing all the kooky things with the rest of his roster. I think Javi Baez is going to be treated for most of the season basically as Rizzo and Bryant. He may move around, but he'll be in the lineup every single day. Even if I don't think the skills have necessarily changed dramatically, you project pretty good skills for every day, it boosts his value very quickly.
That's a pretty good one. All right, I like that one.
Is there anybody that you're completely out on yet?
Completely out on? Who have I been really wrong about? No, I mean, like, look, I was very high on Giancarlo Stanton. I'm not worried about him. Nobody jumps to mind who I – oh, the guy who I feel really stupid about right now, and I just don't know what his problem is, and I'd like to think it's going to fix itself, but I'm getting worried, is in two catcher leagues, I loved Evan Gattis, and – Evan Gattis is playing basically every day, though he's now down to eighth, ninth in the lineup. But he has been quietly spectacular this year. Like, he's been awful. And they just have too many other options at DH. And
he also needs a counter for how many outs there are.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the triple play. Yeah, that's a good call.
So, on the one hand, I love the catcher who doesn't have to catch. On the other hand, like, and, you know, and Houston's winning, Houston's going to be fine. But at some point, they're just going to put a different bat in there. They're not just going to keep running out Gattis. And I just don't know what his problem is. Like, I don't know why he's sucking. But again, it's early enough that he could hit two home runs tomorrow and suddenly be just fine. But I'm getting a little bit about him because two catcher leagues, I can't replace Evan Gattis's production that I projected. Like, you can't. Not just going to pop up.
What about, I was listening to Launch Angle the other day, and you said you don't even hardly look at the standings yet, but how far down or behind do you have to be to kind of start to panic and really make moves to start trying to gain some of these categories back or get wins in a head-to-head league?
Yeah, I mean, so I mostly play the NFBC, so by panicking, it would be cutting players. There's no trading.
Right.
And I'm not cutting anybody yet. I pay attention of, like, I know how my saves are doing, so I know if I really need a closer and if I need to be pounding the wire for everybody who comes up there. A week from now, I'll start paying attention to the standings, though. A week or two from now, I'll start plugging that in and seeing. What I do pay attention, though, to is I still have my projected stats that come down each day as time goes on. So I have a pretty good sense if I still think my team is where I want it to be. Put it this way. So I had Delino DeShields on a bunch of teams. So I don't need to look at the standings to know I'm kind of screwed for speed for this month. I need to go find it. So if I need to pick up Rajai Davis or I need to pick up whatever speed I can try to find, I don't need the standings to tell me that, because maybe I got lucky and got a couple of stolen bases. And at this point, given, you know, the leader in most leagues in stolen bases has what? 12 stolen team stolen bases, 14 stolen bases. So you get two or three random stolen bases, you shoot up there. But I knew I was in trouble in stolen bases. Now Delino came back a lot sooner. I'm less screwed in stolen bases. Standings, I am way better looking objectively at my team still right now, I think, than at standings that can have all kinds of noise and send me in the wrong direction.
I like that. Okay, we definitely need to talk a little bit of Blue Jays here, but we got this. I'm going to kind of intertwine this question because there's a couple guys that you can talk about here, but we did this on the last episode of the podcast, plus we did it on our radio show where we've really been kind of honing in on Ozzie Albies. He's been a very popular name. And we I think it was on the pod, we ended a poll which was Albies versus Alex Bregman. And I don't know if people recalled it, but it was a dead tie. It was, who would you rather have rest of season, Ozzie Albies or Alex Bregman? Dead tie on that one. Then on the radio, we did a Ohtani versus Albies, and Albies won, I think. And we prefaced it by saying,
kind of landslide-ish.
Well, no, it ended 55-45.
Did it really?
Yeah, okay. It was up there for a bit. It was in the 60s. But it was a daily transaction that you get to use him as a hitter and pitcher. So Ozzie Albies has really been a hot name. So what I want to throw at you, and like I said, there's a lot to unpack here. What if we said Ozzie Albies versus Josh Donaldson, who's hurt? There's a lot of people that are getting out. I think Bogman started to say that he was kind of getting out a little bit on Josh Donaldson. So the question is about, what do you think as far as Josh Donaldson rest of season? And then what do you think about that either or of Ozzie versus Donaldson?
You're listening to In This League.
Did you know that you can listen to this show live on the award-winning Fantasy Sports Radio Network? Listen on the iHeartRadio app, the TuneIn Radio app, or download the Fantasy Sports Radio Network app. The Fantasy Sports Radio Network is the only totally free 24/7, 365 Fantasy Sports Network of its kind without a subscription. Check out YouTube Live on the Fantasy Sports Network YouTube page and participate in the programming there, where you can ask questions, discuss the topics with other fantasy enthusiasts, or tell everyone that you disagree. Call into your favorite show and ask your question. The number is 844-84-FNTSY. That's 844-843-6879. The Fantasy Sports Radio Network, your free fantasy source 24 hours a day.
You're listening to In This League Overtime. Some of the best from the In This League Podcast Network. Find all their shows and more of what you've heard at InThisLeague.com.
I mean, I'll give you the cheap answer, and then I'll give you an actual binary answer if I were in a league and I was presented with a trade. If you told me Donaldson gets 500 plate appearances the rest of the season, I take Donaldson. You can't tell me what he's going to do. I don't know that the shoulder is ever going to fully heal this year. He showed the second half of last year how good he can be playing at kind of 80-85%. So he is still, when he's in there, a top 15 to 20 hitter. Fantasy-wise, he obviously doesn't steal the way Albies does, but he still is a top 30 fantasy hitter when he's out there. Problem is, as of today, he's hurt, and he should be back soon, but he also was supposed to be healthy at the beginning of the season.
Right. So
I don't think it's as crazy, the Albies-Donaldson comp, and when I look at my rest of season projections, they're really close. Now, my plate appearances for Donaldson in my rest of season projections are really conservative. They're really quite low. So the cop-out answer depends if I can depends if I need the speed or I need the power. And I'd want to have a really good, honest view of my team, which of those two categories I need more. The more interesting question I'll throw back to you guys. Albies or Acuna?
Oh, yeah, I like that one. Bogman, I think that – didn't we – wasn't that our one in our book? I think
Albies
that's the one in the
versus
book.
Versus Cano?
No, no, you said Acuna.
Yeah, Acuna.
Oh, Acuna.
Yeah, who's about to come up.
Oh, we have. Cano's easy. There's nobody who's taking Cano over Albies at this
point. Yeah, no, not even close.
Acuna, though, I would take
You threw Albies. Way too much Canadian accent on that. I couldn't get it at all.
Every once in a while, the accent slips in.
That one was that actual one was in our book. That debate was Ozzie Albies versus Ronald Acuna. Acuna just heated up, by the way. Everyone that we know was at that game in Pawtucket or wherever the hell it was on Sunday. And I think he's coming up because I actually had somebody ask. I'm not trying to dance around the question, but one of our listeners was like, "Should I worry?" It was Malone Jr. on Twitter, Antoine Malone said, "Is it time to panic and drop Acuna because other prospects are coming up?
How do I get in a league with him?"
I know. I was like, no. Don't do that.
Malone is a college football guy. So.
Yeah, I was like, don't drop Acuna, especially because I think he's coming up this week. Okay, so going around all of that, it's a fantastic question of Acuna versus Ozzie Albies.
I'll take Albies.
I think I'm going to take Albies too because there's a lot of unknowns. And, you know, I marked it in the offseason because of how much I covered Acuna out here in the fall league. I said there's one major thing I'm worried about is he can be streaky and he can be prone to striking out and getting ahead of himself. And this is the rookie year. So and the Braves have already kind of tempered him a bit with this. We want to see him perform. What's going to happen when he performs and he comes up and he struggles? Are they going to send him back down? It's a really weird confidence thing that's going on. It might clearly be Acuna in 6 weeks. But I think Ozzie Albies is just, he's too much on fire. I know he'll come back to earth a little bit, but I really know what I'm getting from him. And I think a lot of what you're getting from Albies, you hope you're going to get from Acuna. So I think I'm going to go Albies. What about you, Rob?
I think we're underestimating just how much power there's going to be in his bat right away. I think playing with Major League Baseball is going to really take off for him. I don't think it's going to be that close. I think Acuna, I would take Acuna in a second. Okay. If I knew he was coming up, like if there's a 3% chance that Alex Anthopoulos is going to play a really silly game and keep him down to June, that would be the only hesitation. But I agree with you. I don't think that's what's going on here. So if you could guarantee me he was going to be up this week, which you can't, but if you did, if we're doing that hypothetical, then I would take him over Albies.
I think it's interesting. That's a really interesting one because it could be close, and I'm probably underselling. And that's happened with me with a couple guys now, Bogman, of guys that I've covered in the minor leagues where I think I get too heady about it, and then, you know, ends like it's same thing with Ian.
What happened with Albies?
Yeah.
You weren't that big on Albies coming up because he looked more like a glove prospect coming up than he did a bat. And, you know, sometimes I know it's cliche to say this, but sometimes it's true. You know, sometimes development in the major leagues does actually work. I think it works more in baseball than it does in any other sport just because you're doing it every single day. You're grinding it out every single day. You're around your coaches and stuff all the time. So sometimes it's just you get to the majors and, the best coaches are in the majors and they fix you. They fix something. And I think it's been working for Albies. Plus, he plays a premium position and he's up right now. So all of that stuff, that's going to make me take all these.
You know why I was skeptical of showing what kind of dummy I am? Because it's stupid analysis. It's because of Swanson. It's because I was like, we thought this guy was going to be the best prospect in baseball, and he wasn't. So don't tell me you guys have another middle infield prospect coming up who's going to be awesome. Prove it to me. And he did.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's a tough one because
just stupid. That's what do the two things have to do other than they play on the same team? It's idiotic.
No,
analysis.
But that's that team stuff though. That's team that stuff though. Yeah, I think I fell into some of that similar bias, especially with I guess it's also an underestimation of how much the Braves will push these prospects through. And you know, Acuña on almost any other team right now, you might have more of that hesitation. And to be honest with you, yeah, I think that I like the idea that you're posing, because even if Acuña gets called up and struggles for his first couple of bats or something like that, I think that window still exists out there that you could move Albies to get Acuña while Albies is still going nuts. But I think that's a fascinating one. I don't have the book pulled up. I wish we could remember who the hell we put on that one and what the result. I feel like the results were out.
The other thing I'd say is I think that the Braves are playing with a bit of smoke and mirrors right now in terms of their record. So I think that I get the point that if he struggles, he may go back down. That's less likely to happen if they're, 12 games under 500 at the All-Star break.
Good point.
Yeah, I'm not really worried about that. But no. I don't think he'll go back down. What about you said I was listening to the podcast and you said you would flip Albies for Nelson Cruz. You still doing that one?
Jeez, I have them. I have the rest of the season. I have them ranked really similarly. Similar to Donaldson, it really depends what I need on my team. And I know, honestly, in most trading leagues, I could get more from Albies than Cruz. So he was a name that popped into my head to kind of make a point. But I think the sexy appeal, given like if you're getting a poll that says Bregman, do Albies in a second, I'd rather Bregman than Nelson Cruz. So I think I'd be probably screwing myself if I just took Nelson Cruz for Albies.
Where did you sit on that one debate real quick, by the way, where we put out that poll of Albies versus Bregman? It was a dead heat, 50-50% on the poll. Where do you sit on it? Which side?
I think I'd rather Bregman, but okay, I'm a small C conservative.
No, that was all of us.
On that, he's just got too much of a track record. Now
we got so I'm looking at the book right now. The Welsh, it was Spore had Albies 10-8. James Anderson had a draw.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
Like, has anybody actually seen the Albies tattoo on Spore's ass officially?
It's definitely on his ass, though. No, it's definitely on his ass. That's 100%.
Does it cover both cheeks, or is it just the one cheek?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I remember I put James on it because James, a big prospect guy, he drawed that. Spore gave it to Albies 10-8.
Brett Sayer was 10-9.
So, okay, so Albies won it. What did I give it, like a 10-9?
10-9, yep.
Okay, so Albies won it against Acuña in the book, and that'll be a fun one. We get the Spore on. We can ask him about that.
Ask about his tattoo on his ass.
Yeah, I think he should live Twitch that. Maybe if he doesn't have it, he can live Twitch his ass getting tattooed with Albies. That would be good. That would be good. Bogman, do we have any others, or do we want to go to the book debates?
I just want to ask real quick, Rob, about Marcus Stroman. We highlighted him at the beginning of the show. He's been god-awful. Is he going to get it back? I mean, I know you said you didn't point him out. You had an ample chance to point him out in a guy you're actually worried about. Should we be concerned, or is this just early season woes and he's going to get it back on track?
He is one of those pitchers who will have these stretches, and somehow you're going to wake up the third week of September as the season's wrapping up, and he's going to be under 4. The whip's going to be kind of high-ish for an ace, but certainly manageable. So it hurts right now, and I'm not, but he's going to have stretches where he's going to be lights out for 3, 4, 5 starts. So I'm not going to lie, if I were redrafting today for the rest of the season, I'm lower on him than I was the day of the draft.
Right.
But that doesn't mean if I have him that I'm not going to get something from him the rest of the way. And I'd hold on to him. I heard another podcast recently that said, wait until you get the one or two decent to good starts and then get out as quickly as you can. The problem is once he has the one or two good starts, you may get 6 or 7 more good starts right afterwards.
Right,
so certainly in DFS, I would wait until he pitches a lights-out game before I start paying up for Stroman.
I like that. We'll do this just real quick. Obviously, Rob took part in our book the 99 Fantasy Baseball player debates. That's still out there because obviously you guys do not know that. Trust me, I know that you don't know that. But it's still out there on Amazon, 99 Fantasy Baseball player debates. Rob was one of our awesome judges.
It's an awesome book. For anybody who hasn't checked it out, it's still really good. You should check it out still. It's really
Thank you.
Good.
You got to read it, though. We should have done an audio book.
Oh, we should have done an audio book.
Yeah, that would have been funny.
Really quick audio.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know what? It would have been great.
We talk fast, plus you can play it.
We would have submitted it two times already, so you don't even have to hit two times. We'll just be like, all right.
The funny thing with the segment coming up, I have no memory of what I actually said to these guys.
And I don't think we do either.
I didn't know who Albies and Acuna was, so it was a blur. So we're just doing a quick look. Anytime any of our wonderful guests that come on took part in the book, we did it with Gardner, we did it with Collette, and we're doing it here with just a couple of the debates, and I think Rob was a part of 15 to 20 of them, and they're great because it's three judges all judging these matchups. And the first one here, this is an interesting one, was Miguel Cabrera versus Andrew McCutchen. You put a draw on the match, and the overall was one of the few split decisions. Bogman, I don't know, you don't happen to have that pulled up since you have the book pulled up. I'd be curious who the other judges were and what the actual split was, but this is a split decision. So the question is, do you still stand by the draw, or do you think there's a clear-cut winner here?
See, just so people can't see my Excel, like I'm going through my Excel spreadsheet with my rest of season projections. I don't want them to think that I f***ed around with my projections just for this, because I care, but I don't care that much. They're literally right next to each other still. So
love it,
Miggy. There are days where I look at him and say, "You're a broken man. And you are not going to make it through this game, never mind this season." And there are other games where he's smoking the baseball. And McCutchen's just plugging along, doing McCutchen things. So to me, it's your risk tolerance. If you were in a hypothetical where you could pick one or the other, McCutchen's floor is higher, Miggy's ceiling is higher.
Yeah, it went Gardner, McCutchen 10-8, Sealy, Cabrera 10-8. Silver draw. So it was a complete split down the middle.
That's a good one. That was a really good one we put together. So it was Sealy, Gardner, and Silver on that one, and everybody drew it out. I like it. All right, Bogman, what's number two on this?
Sano versus Segura. You picked Sano 10-8. The winner overall was Sano 10-9. And this was before we knew Sano wasn't going to get a suspension. So I feel like because of that, you even still went with Sano, this is probably going to be easy. You're still taking Sano, right?
Sano, and it would be by a lot now. It's quite a big gap. It wasn't just the suspension, though. That was a big part of it. He also showed up. I can't remember what date I sent it to you, but he was fat and out of shape.
Really fat.
He looked like me. Yeah.
He looked like he ate Marky Mark.
And he had surgery. So there was huge. There was both suspension risk and injury risk. And Segura's not running yet. And I wouldn't worry too much about that, but he's not running much. So, yeah, like Sano is one guy who has climbed up just because of playing time. My rankings a lot the season started.
This one was actually one of my favorites because it's been kind of a 2 or 3 years in the making here at ITL. We always would talk about these two. And it was Kyle Seager versus Jake Lamb. You took Kyle Seager 10-8. The decision was Kyle Seager 10-8. Jake Lamb, by the way, just had a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a setback, but he's going to rest for a couple more days before he actually does return, even though he was right on the precipice.
Coming back tomorrow,
He had a setback.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, May.
Yeah, he had a setback, so he's going to be resting for 3 or 4 more days here.
Like, but when I say May, it makes it sound like
it does make it sound like it's really far. Date.
That's like a week from now.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So what do you think about this? Do you still – and Kyle Seager did not have a good start or anything like that. So Kyle Seager, Jake Lamb, is maybe all relative, but do you still hold Kyle Seager with a 10-8 win?
Yeah, this was also pre-humidor, I think.
It was.
I would still certainly take Seager over Lamb. I'm not a big Lamb fan. That was before the injury. The injury would, worries me because he may be coming back. I worry, whether the power comes back right away. So I might spread that out a little bit, but it's not a huge spread. But yeah, I would take Seager still.
I like it. Well, people want to go check it out. Like I said, the book's still out there, and there are a whole bunch more that Rob and the rest of the crew did the judging on. And at the end of the season, I definitely think we got to do like a whole, like just we do like a whole episode where we just revamp, take a look at the book, and maybe even like, you know, we'll reach out to some of the people, or we'll reach out to you, Rob, and just see your end of season feelings on any that look crazy. Because that's going to be the fun thing, is any that look crazy.
Two-thirds of them are going to look crazy of mine. I assume I was drunk at the time when I did those.
Well, okay, there you go. That's how we're going to do the episode. We're all just going to get toasted beforehand, and then we'll – I mean, there's really no other way to do a podcast that's inside baseball for listeners is to get toasted, but
especially when people are listening to it at twice speed.
Yeah, so, like, good point.
If you're going to sound drunk on a baseball podcast,
right,
you should sound like really drunk fast.
Such a good point. We can always bring it right back around. All right, he is Rob Silver. Find him on Twitter at Rob Silver. Go listen to Launch Angle. It's the podcast for Fantrax, the big baseball podcast. You can go subscribe to it on iTunes. Do that stuff. Listen to that show. It is, even though, Rob, you are downplaying it, it is smart people, funny, witty people, especially Rob, doing good stuff over there. So I highly suggest you listen to it. And yeah, you know, we're going to steal your time again, Rob. So just be prepared for it.
Anytime. Always fun.
You're listening to In This League Overtime.
Have you ever wanted to have a fantasy expert in the palm of your hand? Or better yet, in the pocket of your khakis? Well, check it out. Now you can. It's the Fantasy Sports Radio Network app. Download it now to your phone, we promise. No weird viruses, no strange tracking things. Just 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of pure fantasy knowledge dropping all over your head. It's the Fantasy Sports Radio Network app. Stop being a weirdo and streaming it online. Get it on your phone. Take it with you everywhere you go.
In This League Overtime. Want more? Go to inthisleague.com. Here's Bogman and the Welsh.
This is the question, and I teased this question in my last episode. So, and I know that you guys did comps for every single player. Did you do that last year too?
No, so that's something that's new to us this year, and we've talked to some people in the NFL and really tried to get a lot of feedback on our process, and that was across the board recommended to us, is to put comps in your evaluations, not necessarily as career trajectory type things, but, you know, stylistic comps where, you know, this is the type of player and how they play and how they win and, you know, how they don't win as well. And so that's kind of the theme with the comps that we did. It's the first year we did that.
And you know the one that jumped off the page, right?
Terrell Owens to Cortland Sutton?
Yep. That's exactly the one. So, yeah. I mean, can you break that down for us? I mean, how because people are going to see that, especially, you know, there's a gigantic contingent of fantasy people that you know, buy your guide and read only over the offensive players and want to know what to expect for their drafts, because we have, you know, first year player drafts, rookie drafts for dynasty leagues, things like that, and they're going to see Cortland Sutton to Terrell Owens and go, well, that's a guy I'm taking number one, so, or, you know, two behind Barkley for some people. So can you break that down with us? And I mean, you don't have to give away too much of the book, but what is it about Cortland Sutton's game that you like?
Yeah. So again, remember here, career, not career trajectory. I'm not predicting a Hall of Fame.
Right.
It's how they play. So it jumped to me, just so many things. First
you
of all,
and
how
Kyle had the same one,
yeah,
too, didn't you?
It was wild. It was an absolutely wild moment. And so Kyle did his evaluation before mine. And so we were very much like, we don't cross until we're done. And right. So I finished my evaluation. I sent Kyle a text message and I said, Cortland Sutton is Terrell Owens. And then he sent me a screenshot of his already written report. And it was just, wild. And it's just his mannerisms, the way he plays. I mean, he's obviously got the post up above the rim game, you know, where he can be a red zone chain moving type player. You know, really the size and physicality at the catch point is something we get across the board on both players. But then it's the size element that they give you, as well as some flexibility as a route runner. These are guys both that really excelled at really snapping around their breaks and sinking their hips and really turning. And, you know, it's, you don't see that from guys that are 6'3", 225 pounds. And, you know, that was something else that really reminded me of the two. And then it was like the yards after the catch. And so that was kind of the icing in the cake, is both of those guys could create after the catch, big guys that, you know, they can make that first guy miss and they accelerate. And just seeing people of that size moving like that, and kind of just the way that they attacked coverage and the way that they attacked tacklers, it was just really reminiscent. And you know, I certainly, Courtland Sutton would kill for the career Terrell Owens had. But, you know, from a stylistic and utilization standpoint, you know, I think that's the type of play you're getting in Courtland Sutton. Now, you know, I think it's probably appropriate for me also to say, you know, he's not a top 10 player on my board. He's my only wide receiver with a first round grade. But like, you know, he's not perfect. So, you know, there's things that I would like to see more out of him in terms of a little bit more acceleration out of his breaks and a little bit more consistency. Creating separation, things like that. But from a stylistic standpoint, I was really comfortable with that, and you know, I think they really have a lot of similarities.
You know, something caught me when you were talking there about Courtland Sutton, and you said it about Saquon too, and you said, you know, these guys aren't perfect. Is there a perfect type of prospect that you have seen? I mean, obviously, you know, every guy is going to come with strengths and weaknesses. What is the player, and this is, like I said, completely off the cuff, so yeah, you know, if this is too much, what is the closest to perfect prospect you've ever seen?
Quentin Nelson.
Quentin Nelson, really?
Yeah.
From this class, Quentin Nelson.
This class, yeah. And I'm careful with these types of answers. I got to be honest. You know what I mean?
You know, you look like a silly goose if he's,
sure,
you know, a terrible player, so...
Yeah, I mean, he's just a guy. Show me the weaknesses. Let's watch the tape together and show me the weaknesses. I mean, he is an absolute ass kicker in the run game. I mean, he moves men against their will, and he literally makes it look like they're on ice skates. And it's not necessarily that he's just overpowering, right? Because we've seen powerful guys enter the NFL, and that is mitigated, right? Because the other guys in the NFL are powerful too, but it's the technique that he uses to generate that power that makes me so excited about him. I mean, it's the upward thrust. It's unlocking the hips. It's accelerating his feet. It's staying square. It's grip strength. It's leverage. It's all the stuff, man, as a run blocker. And then you see this guy in pass pro, and he is about one of the most sharp mental processors I've ever seen in terms of dissecting where the rush is going to be coming, and passing off twists and stunts and those delayed rushers, and working back across the formation. And when he's uncovered, you know, he's just so exceptional to help where his offense most needs it. And then, you know, you can stack power on top of him. He's going to absorb that all day long. He's going to stay square and mirror. He wins in space. I mean, maybe you wish he was a little more athletic, but man, I mean, that is splitting hairs. I mean,
right.
He just has the upside to be the best offensive lineman in the NFL. And I said in a tweet at sometime recently, it's not just that he's the safest pick. It's that he's
the best pick.
It's just that he has the type of upside to be the best player at his position in the NFL. And I don't think I'm a victim of the moment. I've done hundreds and hundreds of evaluations. He's just the guy that, you know, if I'm going to say, okay, who's the one guy that's perfect, you know, he's the guy that I feel most comfortable about.
Man, that is it. So if the Giants took him at two, everyone's going to be blown away, because the old mantra is you don't take guards that high and all that stuff. You're going to be perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, so he's the number one player on my board. And, you know, I think we look at that Andrew Norwell deal this year that Jacksonville gave. I mean, the guard position is so important, too. There's so much inside-outside zone concepts now in the NFL rushing attacks, where it really requires these interior offensive linemen to reach, block, and seal at the second level. So it's not just these big dudes that can move bodies, right? Like, you need to be able to do so much more on the interior. And I think seeing players that can do that get rewarded with big contracts really speaks to the positional value increasing on the interior. And I still believe you can get, you know, quality starters in the middle rounds, but you got an exceptional player like Quentin Nelson, and you see some of these salaries and stuff. And I think it's of equal importance to outside at tackle. I mean, you've got to block Aaron Darnold. You got to block Fletcher Cox, man.
Yeah.
You need these guys that can do that. It's not just Ted Washington in the middle anymore, you know, rushing the passer, just going to play patty cake with the interior blockers and, you know, make sure that the quarterback doesn't flee the pocket. You know, man, these guys are juiced up guys, and you got to block them. And so, the interior offensive line is on the uptick in terms of positional value, and I wouldn't blink an eye if they took him at number two.
Man, that is, I mean, that's a fantastic answer. I love Quinn Nelson, and my co-host, the Welsh, on In This League, he's a gigantic Niners fan, and he just wants all the skill position players because he's a fantasy guy like I am. But I keep telling him, I'm like, man, you're going to be really happy when they take Quinn Nelson at nine, if he even falls that far. And he's like, no, I want like Cortland Sutton, or I want to take one of these running backs. And I'm like, no, man, you want Quentin Nelson. So that I'm going to play this for him and laugh at him. So he's going to be going to be very upset. So I've tried to hold off on too many fantasy questions, but we're going to get in the fantasy weeds a little bit here. This tight end class seems fairly deep. As far as fantasy goes, is Goddard far and away the best option for us in like our rookie drafts out of this class?
You know, the hardest thing about fantasy questions right now is just that we don't know what team these guys are.
Right.
You know, so if Dallas Goedert, you know, it goes to a certain team, you know, I think that's going to present a lot more value than others. So, you know, without knowing, you know, who the quarterback is and what the scheme is and which players are around them, you know, I think Dallas Goedert's the best tight end in this class.
Let me reword it then. Which tight end out of this class has the highest upside for a lot of receptions early?
Yeah, I think it's Goedert, and I think Mike Gesicki's right there with them. I mean, really athletic big guys that can stretch the field, win in the deep middle. Both guys that can go up and get the football, and make exceptional ball skills. Guys that you know they can have bodies draped around them, and they can still go up and get it. And so, you know, that's going to lead to a lot of targets at all levels of the field and in all areas of the field. So, those are the two guys for me that I think present the most upside in terms of production right away.
All right, so I got two more for you. The next one is, who are some of your favorite late running backs and wide receivers from this class? Like the late round type of guys you have between, you know, maybe round three to the end of the draft.
Yeah, so running back, Nyheim Hines out of NC State, not just because the food's good there, but he's a good player, man. And so, you know, I talk about these zone running concepts, and that's what they did at NC State. And so his ability to kind of anticipate those creases is really strong. And then he's just electric, you know, sub 4.4. He's a 4.3 guy in terms of his speed, and he's got really good balance and a lot of good twitch in space. And so I think he's the type of guy that could find some production, you know, that's outside of this top tier of backs. I also like John Kelly from Tennessee. He's got really good vision, but he's super powerful and a guy that he just is able to sustain his momentum through contact so well. That balance, I mean, like we saw that from Alvin Kamara. Maybe not as elusive as Kamara, but in terms of balance and being able to continue moving is something you really get from John Kelly. And that offensive line was just terrible last year, and he was able to really find some production. And it really was on account of himself. He created that for himself with how well he can sustain through contact. In terms of wide receivers, I guess sleeper type guys, I really like Cedric Wilson out of Boise State. Two-year player for Boise State, a JUCO guy that has a quarterback background, but has made a really good transition to receiver, runs good routes, good hands, has some juice to him, and I think that he can also create after the catch. So I love those guys that have three levels, you know, the ability to make plays at every level of the field. And let me give you another receiver here. I really like from Colorado State, Michael Gallup.
Yeah.
He's a guy that reminds me of Pierre Garçon. I mean, he's got some really good physicality to his game, and I think that's so important at the next level, being able to break through that contact at the release and through the contact window and at the catch point and when, you know, at the top of your breaks, be able to use that. And he's got enough juice to separate, and he's a real alpha when he goes and attacks the football. So, you know, in the right scheme and the right system, you know, he can find some production as well.
See, you hit the perfect transition for the last question. So, and this is the one that us fantasy guys are going to be really excited about. Can you give us a few perfect scenarios for some of the offensive skill position players? So, like if, you know, Cortland Sutton landed with team whatever, that would be perfect for his immediate production. Can you give us some of those?
Yeah, there's a few that come to mind. It's Courtland Sutton to the Dallas Cowboys.
Love it.
I mean, they need an X receiver because they chose to release Dez Bryant. And so, you know, he can kind of step in right away and demand targets and, you know, give Dak Prescott a guy that he can trust throwing the football in the red zone and to keep drives moving. I really love the idea of Nick Chubb to the Carolina Panthers. I mentioned, you know, earlier about Penny to that type of role, but I think Nick Chubb is just the absolute dream for that turn into a productive opportunity to complement Christian McCaffrey. I really like the idea of, I guess a couple of different tight ends, but we'll go with Mike Gesicki to the New Orleans Saints. You know, that is a roster that has really become very complete in recent years. And, you know, I think they're kind of looking for that X factor type player. And you talk about a guy that can bust the seam and really stretch defenses. And, you know, he had a combine that was comparable to Vernon Davis. I mean, just a ridiculous athlete. You see him win at the catch point, so let's give him to Drew Brees.
But does he paint like Vernon Davis?
I don't think so. Yeah, I do a lot of work on these guys, and that's not something I've been able to uncover. So
I just remember that from Vernon Davis's like draft day or whatever. They're like, and he's a painter. I'm like, why does that matter? Who cares?
Yeah. So let me give you a quarterback here as well.
Yeah,
a quarterback that I think would be just an ideal fit. Oh, I got so many that I like, but I'll go with Lamar Jackson to the Cardinals.
Love it.
It's you think about Mike McCoy and their offensive coordinator and how he's been able to really tailor his offense to so many different types of quarterbacks, and there's so many different elements to his scheme that I think can really work for Lamar. You know, it's not just an Air Coryell. It's just not an Earhart Perkins or a West Coast scheme. It's got the best of all of it put together. And that's what Lamar's going to need. You know, a guy that's not going to box him in and not let him be the dual threat guy that he is, but also, you know, tailoring the passing game to what he does well, something we've seen Mike McCoy do. And I would really like to see that marriage.
So for when I write my NFL draft guide, which I never will because I just follow too many sports to do it. Yeah, I had a comp of Ronald Jones to Robert Smith from the Vikings. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I like it here. Yeah, that's good. I like that one. The easy one for Ronald Jones has been Jamal Charles. I think everyone wants to go there. But
and I'm a Texas fan, so I love Jamal Charles. But whenever I saw him run, it just I saw Robert Smith from the Vikings.
Yeah, I can get behind that. I mean, a lot of really good vision across the board for both players, and just the ability to have that juice and wiggle, and they make electric cuts, and I can get behind that. I can.
All right, you see, I'm an expert now too. Joe Marino said so. Well, hey, thanks for coming by, man, and tell us about the guide. Tell everybody why they should get it. I already bought it, so you already sold me.
Yeah, thanks so much. So I've got my NFL draft scouting portfolio. It's available at ndtscouting.com. There's also a pinned tweet to the top of my Twitter at the Joe Marino, and I did 300 in-depth evaluations on the prospects available for this draft. And what I think really makes it unique is we try to paint a really high resolution picture of these prospects by incorporating every important aspect of an evaluation and scoring it with a numerical weighted score. And what that does is it puts all of the prospects through the same criteria. It's a very consistent way of looking at these players, and it really takes out the bias. And that's something that as evaluators, we have to really fight. You know, it just comes there. But when you strip it down to literally every little piece of it and putting a number score on it, I think it really gives you a true representation of what's the most important things about evaluating a player. Because otherwise, you're just watching a guy saying, oh, that guy's worth the number two pick. This guy's worth the seventh round pick. And it's just based on feel. Well, I think you miss that way. And so we outline those all in our work and score everything. And I think that's what really makes it a worthwhile purchase for you and something that really breaks it down. And you can see very specifically the strengths and weaknesses from, you know, not just a high level, but getting into the weeds and really understanding everything you'd want to know about these players. So would appreciate and be honored for anyone's consideration.
Hey, thanks, man. And remember, you can find him on Twitter at the Joe Marino. You can find his writing at FanRag and at NDT Scouting, and catch his podcast at Draft Dudes. Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
This was In This League Overtime. Some of the best from the In This League podcasts. Visit In This League.